You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 7th of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, and Gillian DeBias.
And coming up on today's programme, Wagner, Union Jacks and a lady at the helm of The Last Night. Where else could we be but the proms in London? Plus...
That was just a little taste of one of the choices of today's music review. We'll be heading to New York a little later on. We'll also be finding out what to get up to if you're at a loose end in Madrid over the next 48 hours.
Like a jolt of post-vacation adrenaline, Madrid comes roaring back to life after the annual August exodus.
And we'll be getting an artist's perspective on some international exhibitions around the world this summer.
So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Studio One at Midori House on Saturday. Emma, hi.
A very warm welcome to Studio One, Gillian DeBias. We are recovering from a lovely night at the proms last night, more of which we'll talk about in just a few moments' time, because Jasper Rees, our resident critic, is in, ready and raring to go and talk about the last 3-4 weeks of culture in London.
But you've outdone me. You've had such a cultural week, Emma Nelson.
Well, just a little bit. We did a little bit of... I did my London Landmark Culture Week. So as well as the proms, which is, you know, obviously what London is brilliant at when it comes to classical music, I paid my first visit to the Globe Theatre.
That's extraordinary for a Londoner like you.
It is extraordinary. But it happened. And it was possibly the perfect time to do it because we have enjoyed the summer to end all summers, and going to the Globe was the best thing to do on a sunny Sunday evening. Production aside, which was okay, I went to see the Scottish play. It was a really, really thrilling experience to go to when the theatrical event, the actual act of watching became a really big, exciting thing to do. You didn't just plonk yourself on a seat,
did you get a sense, because sometimes it can be a bit touristy, the Globe, but did you get a sense that the actors are getting as much out of performing there as the audience seeing it in Shakespeare's sort of original theatre?
Absolutely, because they place a lot of the action within the space of the Globe as well, and you are absolutely right next to them. It's a very, very participatory, I suppose is the way to describe it. They're absolutely in the thick of it, and the beginning and the end is done very, very traditionally when all the players come on and perform a piece of music. So they sort of take you in and out of the play by saying, here we are, we're some actors and we're going to do you a play. And then at the end of it, they sort of bring you out of the experience, which was strange because Macbeth is always one of those, you know, terribly desperate things when everybody's dead at the end. And
you don't associate that with a lovely outdoor summer evening.
No, you don't. It was a production that was played slightly too much for laughs as well, which is really tricky when you're dealing with one of, you know, Shakespeare's most bloody tragedies. But I would recommend anybody to go to the Globe Theatre just simply to sit there and think, no, not this is how it was done, but actually this being done now is great.
But also it was such a labour of love to restore that theatre, and you got to love that.
Yeah, Sam Wanamaker, just absolute testament to what he did. And they're in the process of creating a space which will have a roof on it, which completely contradicts what the whole point of the Globe was there for in the first place, but obviously it means that they can play right through the year. So it was great, it was great. And the last night of the proms is tonight here in London. They're queuing up now, those who did not get their tickets now. So you and I went to your first prom last night.
Yes, I was a prom virgin. And it was...
I don't know quite what to say about that. Let's press on, shall we? Jasper is ready and waiting.
Hi there.
As you may have just heard. Now, the queues have formed already about a mile and a half from this studio here in London of a certain kind of music lover who only seems to emerge Union Jack Jester Hat at the ready once a year. They're trying to go, of course, to get into the Royal Albert Hall for the last night of the proms. It's an evening which, for some reason, always seems to overshadow the previous 74 perfectly good concerts with a rather hackneyed kind of jingoism.
This year, audiences have enjoyed a series of firsts. The conductor, Daniel Birnbaum, and the Berlin Staatskapelle performing Wagner's complete and enormous Ring cycle. And tonight, American Marion Alsop will become the first woman to take to the podium to conduct the last night of the proms and to marshal the flag-waving devotees in jester hats. So, does this strange mix of art, classical culture and British populism still work? One man unraveling his Union Jack in readiness for tonight is Jasper Rees, cultural commentator at theartsdesk.com. Hi, Jasper.
Hi there, Cole. You got me stereotyped there.
Oh, too tempting.
But it's funny... Kansas rules the waves tonight because it's going to be the Rule Britannia will be sung by Joyce DiDonato, the American mezzo-soprano. So it's not all about Britain.
No.
If you go to the last night of proms, there are flags from all over the world. And I think it's worth pointing out before we say anything about the proms is that I've got some statistics here about how widely the proms are listened to by national broadcasters all over the world. The whole series is taken in Australia, New Zealand and Finland. 50 to 60 concerts are taken in Poland, Romania and Portugal, 40 to 50 in the US, Estonia and Austria, and so on. And you can listen to the proms anywhere in the world so long as you can get online, because every concert is broadcast online and you can listen to it on the BBC iPlayer for a week afterwards.
I mean, it is amazing because here there's, you know, quite an event and it's the happening. But there it really is. If it's broadcast so widely and so widely picked up, it is devotees of music. Like, they really are following the exceptional music.
Absolutely. It is a great celebration of classical music. The fact that it happens to take place in London is great if you're a Londoner, but it's all inclusive. They have performers from all over the world, and people come to listen from all over the world as well.
I wonder if therefore there are two sorts of proms: the proms that perhaps British popular culture sees, which is the flag wavers on the last night and the Rule Britannias, and then the rest of the world actually gets a fantastic couple of months of really, really world-class broadcasting and world-class classical music, which we have enjoyed this year. I mean, having been to a couple in the past few years, this year knocked me for six. I'm not entirely sure why. Was it a particularly good year?
It was a great year, and I think what this year is going to be remembered for is the thing that you've already mentioned, which is those seven Wagner performances, which were... I only went to one, but I listened to all of the rest on the radio, and they were quite astonishing. And it's a measure of how extraordinary they were. That at the end of the final opera in the Ring cycle, Götterdämmerung, there was a 10-second silence, which has been widely remarked upon as the most extraordinary sound of the whole of the prom season, and possibly of any prom season, because the audience had been... I won't say battered into submission, but they'd certainly been so stunned by what they'd heard that the only response was this silence, which was kind of controlled by the conductor, Daniel Barenboim.
Now, I'm not an expert in the area, so I'm curious to know why it was so spectacular. I mean, here it is. It's a concert performance. You don't have the sets. You don't have the costumes. And what makes this presentation exceptional?
If you go to Wagner productions, people would probably say that not having the sets is a blessed relief. Because the last time you saw Rheingold, didn't you, Emma? This year, but the last time I saw Rheingold, the set looked like something that was a cast off from Doctor Who in the 1970s.
They do. They have a tendency. Wagner opera directors have a tendency to put literally the kitchen sink on the stage. And I think that Bayreuth, which obviously is the home of the Ring, gets constantly pilloried in the press for the absurd productions. But this, for me, I was a Wagner performance virgin until Rheingold. And I remember just sitting there thinking, well, okay, I've got 3.5 hours to get through this. And I was astonished. The first bar of the first... you know, just the first bit, and hairs on the back of my arms just went straight up, and I thought, I'm listening to something that's incredible and incredibly new. And I was astonished, as Jasper mentioned, by the way that the audience were totally transfixed. I mean, last night when we went, I was aware that people were coughing and fidgeting and this, that and the other. They didn't move when they were watching Daniel Barenboim and the orchestra go. And it was one of those things that I actually didn't really mind. I followed the libretto completely word for word and really enjoyed a very pleasurable, complete musical event without, as Jasper said, being distracted by something bonkers happening. Because the way that the Wagner has written an opera, which is a huge opera, which is practically unstageable. You have to have funeral pyres. You have to have serpents. You have to have, you know, the Rhine. You have to have a huge castle. It's pretty damned impossible to actually stage it well.
But the great thing about the music is that all of the sets, all of the visuals, all of the lighting are in the music. It's like in Shakespeare. You don't need all of the extra gubbins in Shakespeare, because it's all there in the verse, and it's the same thing with Wagner, and that is why going to see these operas performed without all of this extra distraction was just fantastic.
What I found amazing is when everything's sort of stripped bare, you just watch the orchestra playing and you watch the rhythm of the bows and you watch the drum. So it's kind of hypnotic. You're just really drawn in to see the music being played. I found that amazing.
I quite enjoyed the spin-off discussions that have been associated with this year's proms. Not least, I mean, we'll come to Marion Alsop in a moment, the first woman director of the proms last night. She was more surprised than anybody that no one had done it before. But just briefly touching on Wagner, there was a huge amount of discussion associated with whether Wagner is, you know, he's such a difficult composer to come to terms with, given his blatant anti-Semitism. And so it suddenly opened the question, can you enjoy the art of someone who was so morally tainted? And I love listening to that and think, and actually so having to question myself, you know, am I all right to enjoy a bit of Wagner? Is there something wrong with me?
That debate has been running and running for a long time, and it's going to carry on running for a long time. I don't know where I sit in that particular discussion, but I do know that I love listening to the music.
Yeah.
And to be immersed in that sound world was just quite extraordinary. And the great thing about, you said that people listened intently. The great thing was that a lot of young people went to queued, and you could get in for a fiver, which is extraordinary. To hear something like that for £5, to stand for 6 hours and watch Wagner, pound an hour, was and to be completely absorbed was an extraordinary thing. So there are many, many new converts to Wagner's music as a result of this summer season.
Last night we heard the Vienna Philharmonic, and I'm interested in both your takes. One of the beautiful things about the proms is it really brings orchestras from all over the world, and you have the best in the world. What makes the Vienna Philharmonic so special?
Well, I like them because they have the most astonishing brass section. I'm a bit of a obsessive when it comes to the French horn. I've written a book about the French horn, and the Viennese horn section is just extraordinary. They play on these 19th century horns, which, without blinding anyone with science, are quite difficult to play. And so you do hear the odd blip, the odd mistake, but the sound that they produce for them, as was evident in the second and the fourth movement last night, is just mind-blowing. It's got this extraordinary sheen.
And for me, it's the same, but replace that word French horn with strings, although I have not written a book about any kind of string instrument or any instrument at all. Again, as Jasper said, it's these 19th century instruments. The Vienna Philharmonic, their players play the Philharmonic's instruments. They don't own their own instruments.
That's extraordinary.
So the Viennese will always have a very particular sound. And the string section I always find absolutely blinding. The Viennese get a very, very good... They're supposed to be the best orchestra in the world. I have a big problem with them, which is until 1997, women couldn't be full-time members of the orchestra.
They've just got six now, apparently.
But you count them when they walk on.
I know.
That's so recent. That's extraordinary.
But it's gone up, because when I last counted, it was four.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I remember one year just thinking, three women, we've broken it, we're absolutely fine, we're onto a winner, we have total emancipation here. It's absolutely astonishing. And it perhaps shows what a difficult job ahead of her Marion Alsop, tonight's last night conductor, has. Or in fact, the distance that this girl has travelled. Because she's, I think she's in her early 50s, and she hasn't yet conducted an absolute top-flight orchestra. I wonder what it's going to be like when she does get her hands on the likes of the Viennese and the Berliners. Whether they'll ever let her through the door is a different matter. But I saw her conduct the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment a couple of weeks ago, doing Brahms's German Requiem. Not something that I really wanted to hear on period instruments. I thought it was going to be awful. I knew it would have to be played very fast. But she was electrifying. And I thought, this is really, again, the proms has broken another mould. They've got a world-class director, world-class conductor here, who is fantastic to watch and should be great on television tonight. She will make it a really, really good event to watch if you're at home.
Jasper, what else? What are the highlights tonight?
The highlight, well, We're talking about American artists, and I mentioned Joyce DiDonato earlier. She's going to be fantastic singing. And one of the innovations of the Proms in last night at the Proms in recent years has been "You'll Never Walk Alone" being sung not only in the hall but on four different places where Proms in the parks happen around the United Kingdom. And she'll be leading that. I'm really looking forward to Nigel Kennedy, the bad boy of British violin playing, doing what was recently voted the most popular piece of music in this country, Lark Ascending by Vaughan Williams. I can't quite connect Nigel Kennedy with Lark Ascending, so it's going to be fascinating to hear what he does with it.
Yeah, I must. I have to shut my eyes if I listen to anything he does. I just want to thump him, which is what, terrible.
You're saying you don't like spiky hair?
I don't like Nigel Kennedy and his spiky. I think he's a fantastic musician, but I think we'll have to leave it at that. Jasper Rees, thank you very much as ever for joining us in the studio. The last night of the Proms is broadcast in about 7-ish hours' time, so wherever you are, tune in if you fancy seeing the jester hats, but also a little bit of quite brilliant culture. In the meantime, though, you're listening to The Review. In a moment, we look at some of the other things going on around the world this weekend.
You've read the magazine, you've listened to the radio, and you've even made it to our new cafe. But now there's more, so much more. Hitting bookshelves this September is Monocle's first book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living. It's a quiet manifesto for doing things well that runs from the macro to the micro. Over 400 pages of fresh editorial, great illustrations, and stunning photography. We look at what makes a great city, how to build a home you'll always love, why it's good to have a Shiba Ken dog by your side and a cocktail from the Dragonfly Bar in your hand. The Monocle Guide to Better Living will be available in good bookshops around the world and is also available to order now at monocle.com. Happy reading.
Time now to find out what you could be getting up to with a little spare time on your hands this weekend. Here's Nelly Gotcheva with a cultural look ahead for the next couple of days.
As the 39th Toronto International Film Festival takes over the city, the Museum of Contemporary Canadian Art celebrates one of Canada's most successful and controversial directors, David Cronenberg. The Toronto International Film Festival has commissioned brand new works by six Canadian and international artists who share the director's fascination with human psychology. On show are short films, installation and sculptures inspired by the Canadian director. David Cronenberg's transformation is at MoCA until the end of December. If in New York this weekend, kick off the autumn art season with a neighborhood-wide celebration on Sunday. Over 40 galleries in the Lower East Side will be hosting their opening receptions, including Artifact and Gallery 95. Make sure to also swing by Orchard Street for a block party with live music and fashion that will start at 4 p.m. In Brussels, kicking off this weekend at Gallery Paris Beijing is the new Photography in Korea exhibition. It presents the works of about 15 photographers portraying main political and cultural events from the region in the late 20th century. New Photography in Korea is on until the 2nd of November. In Hong Kong, the Blind Spot Gallery welcomes Every Daily, an exhibition by Chinese photographer Ho Siu Nam. It's a breakthrough show in Ho's career as it is the first to incorporate the element of painting in his black and white photography. Every Daily is on until the 28th of September. For more details, go to blindspotgallery.com. And this weekend we are listening to the new album from Volcano Choir entitled Repay. Volcano Choir is the other band of Bon Iver's frontman Justin Vernon. And now let's hear Bygone. Somewhere I heard you scream. For Monocle in Toronto, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
Kano Choir there with Bygone, ending that report by Nelly Gotcheva.
And it's time now for our weekly music review. And today we're crossing to New York to touch base again with Tim Lee, founder of the Tummy Touch record label.
Tim started his career playing Hammond organ for the 1980s pop stars and is now a DJ, producer and regular radio host alongside running the Tummy Touch label, who've just released a new album, Yes Wave, the now sound of NYC in London.
To give us a little taster and share some other new music with us, Tim joined us on the line now. Tim, welcome back to the review.
Hi, good morning. How are you doing?
Good, good, good. So has it been a good summer of music over in New York?
It's been a great summer of music, yeah. I've been involved in a music festival over here called the Wassaic Project. And actually a lot of the bands that are on my compilation sort of came to my attention through, you know, looking to book bands for the festival. So, yeah, I've had a great summer of music discovery.
What have been your particular discoveries and how have you made sure that other people get to hear about them?
Well, I guess the main vehicle is this new compilation, the Yes Wave compilation. I was sort of picking up a common thread amongst a lot of the music that I was digging. And, you know, I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And in fact, you know, I'd asked around, you know, friends in the industry, I'm like, listen to this, these are the same, but what is it? And actually my friend Kevin from Royal Potato Family Records, he said, that's Yes Wave.
So, no room for hesitation, with every step I want to drop, sat down, but all the seats were taken, I didn't hear the music stop.
That was See Me On My Way by Superhuman Happiness, the choice of Tim Lee, founder of the Tummy Touch record label, who joins us on the line from New York to bring us this week's reviews, music review. Tim, that's a very happy, bouncy, almost summery tune now. How did you find it?
The band Superhuman Happiness kind of made up of New York's finest session guys, basically. So I had come across most of the band in one form or another. About half of them were the bands for the Fella musical. So I knew them and had heard rumors that the guys had been making music together, but, you know, took a while before I'd actually heard some. So I was sort of primed and ready to be excited about them when I finally heard some recordings. Sometimes, you know, there's like 14 of them on stage. It's quite something else.
It says here that they are regulars of Brooklyn's famed Zebulon. Is that a good place to perform?
Zebulon was a good place to perform, but now
closed down.
Oh, there we go. Pretty crummy gig.
Well, Superhuman Happiness's album Hands is released later on this year. Tim, let's move on to your second choice. Oh, before we do, just remind us that is on your the Superhuman Happiness feature on your new album from Tummy Touch. So tell us a little bit more about what helped you decide to choose what you put on your compilation.
The Yes Wave compilation. I mean, it's a sound, you know, there's a sound common to everything on there and a kind of feeling. And I guess the most important aspect is there's a very high level of musicianship. You know, this isn't bedroom music. It's not, you know, techno music in that it's made by machines. You know, it's really made by groups of very highly trained musicians, which is a little bit different from the norm at the moment. You know, if anything sort of, you know, binds them together, it's that sort of joyful high quality musicianship.
Let's move on to Dear Georgiana, Don't Let Me Go from Alabama. Tim, tell us a little bit more about your next track.
Dear Georgiana is, in fact, Lauren Bulthrop, who has a band with her brother called Bulthrop, Alabama, which is named after the town they come from. And she was in a group that we were working with a couple of years ago called the Bandana Splits. And again, this is one of those albums I had heard rumor of for the last few years. Oh, I'm working on this. You must hear it. You must hear it. Finally got to hear it and was blown away. Just really very beautiful. She's got such a fantastic voice. Originally had called herself Georgiana Starlington, only to find out there was another band with the same name, which seemed almost impossible, but there you go.
Let's have a listen to Don't Let Me Go. And that was Dear Georgiana, Don't Let Me Go. Dear Georgiana will be playing at the Cameo Gallery on the 25th of October. Tickets apparently are still available. Possibly Tim Lee, founder of Tummy Touch record label and man who selected Dear Georgiana. You will be going to it, we assume, Tim?
I have to admit that I won't, actually, because I'll be in London. I'll be in London. Our publishing company is celebrating its 10th birthday that day.
How lovely. You mentioned there, though, that when you were compiling your album, Yes Wave, you wanted to return to the art of musicianship. I mean, how difficult or easy is it to actually convince an audience nowadays that this is what really music is all about?
Goodness, I don't know. I mean, I've convinced myself and an office full of people. Beyond that, I don't know. You know, it's out there. It's had some good reactions. I mean, the music is doing very well. Melt Yourself Down, who are featured on the compilation, have been, you know, doing very well, certainly in the UK at the moment, and are hotly tipped, to be nominated for a Mercury. So I guess, you know, people are ready for musicianship, yes.
And you have Yes Wave. Is there a No Wave?
Well, No Wave, yeah. No, this is the point. No Wave came out of the New Wave thing in New York. You know, No Wave was the kind of punk rock reaction to New Wave, in that it was very DIY, very, you know, homemade. And, you know, it's great and it's beautiful and it serves a purpose, but this is kind of the opposite of that, in that it's, you know, it's highly, not necessarily highly polished, but, you know, very well executed.
Let's move on to your next track, Tim. This is Samuel Purdy, who aren't one but are two people, aren't they? This isn't a new track. Why have you decided that we should hear it?
These guys recorded an album at Sony's expense, a very, very expensive record in the early 90s, which never got released. The song that we hear was actually released in Japan as a single, but the whole album was never released. Sony just sat on it and then gave up. And the guys approached us a couple of years ago, and, you know, we jumped at the chance of finally, you know, helping to get that album released. So to me, it sounds like a long-lost Doobie Brothers record, which can only be a good thing.
Let's hear it. It's Samuel Purdy and Lucky Radio. Samuel Purdy there and Lucky Radio, the choice of Tim Lee from Tummy Touch Records, who is the reviewer of music on this week's review here on Monocle 24. Tim, how did you feel about releasing something which Sony, you said, had sat on for a couple of decades? It must have been a delight both for you, but also, more importantly, for Samuel Purdy, who probably was wondering what was ever going to happen to their music.
Oh, definitely, yeah. They had long given up on it. It's just... Barney, the one main songwriter, had sort of, you know, kept it, you know, locked in a cupboard and sort of badgered people every time he saw them, and I guess the perseverance finally paid off.
It says that they're originally from Brighton. Is there a good music scene at the moment in Brighton?
There's always a great music scene in Brighton. I think if there's a week goes by where we're not looking to sign a band from Brighton, it's a surprise.
And what's the sound there? Is there something distinctive going on down there, bubbling up?
There's a lot of cross-fertilization between scenes because it's relatively small and you get a lot of the same people cropping up in different bands. So there's quite a lot of sort of, you know, cross-breeding, as it were, between different sort of sounds that's exciting down there.
Tim, let's move on to your final choice. This is from the Tommy Chuch Yes Wave compilation. This is Going Home. The artist, it's an interesting track due to the use of, possibly for the first time on Monocle 24, the use of a clarinet.
Yeah, there's a young saxophone player from the UK called Shabaka Hutchings. This is his band. And there's clarinet all over the album. The album will be out on, not on Tommy Chuch, but on Naim, N-A-I-M Records, some point soon. And it's just really remarkable musicianship and sort of very interesting compositions, but still, you know, so much fun and so sort of, hooky. I'm a big fan.
Well, let's have a listen to it. But before that, let's say goodbye and thank you very much indeed to Tim Lee, founder of Tommy Chuch record label, today's music reviewer here on Monocle 24, and a man who gamefully got up very, very early in New York to do that interview for us. Thank you very much indeed, Tim. Let's have a listen to this and Sons of Kemet, Going Home. Sons of Kemet there. The track was called Going Home. It's from Yes Wave, the now sound of NYC and London, which is a new album from Tim Lee, today's music guest from the Tommy Chuch record label. See, I said it right. The time is 43 minutes past the hour. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24, and it's time to cross to Madrid.
Indeed, where Monocle's Liam Aldous is here to guide us through his picks of the city's cultural highlights this weekend.
Like a jolt of post-vacation adrenaline, Madrid comes roaring back to life after the annual August exodus, and well-rested city residents will need to pick up the pace in September if they plan on keeping up. Madrid's answer to Broadway, Gran Vía, is celebrating the second coming of one of its local smash hits. Over 2.5 million spectators have seen the musical Hoy No Me Puedo Levantar, and this is set to grow with a brand new production opening this month. Based on the 1980s pop group Mecano, the story charters Spain's unbridled post-dictatorship cultural transition over the same decade. Taking place on the streets of Madrid, this period is affectionately known as La Movida Madrileña. The grand premiere at Madrid's Coliseum Theatre will take place on September 12. Madrid's community of independent galleries and artists will band together for the fourth edition of Apertura from the 19th to the 22nd of September. Organized by Arte Madrid, simultaneous exhibition openings will take place in over 50 contemporary art galleries, transforming some of the city's most artistic neighborhoods into a thriving celebration of modern expression.
Los galeristas estamos deseosos de recibir una gran cantidad de visitantes.
International and local artists will all be showing, and the hotbed of artistic talent can be found in the Salesas district, El Barrio de las Letras, or on Dr. Forquet Street. Held over the same dates, Madrid's street-side, suburb-wide interior design festival, Decoracion, will bring the streets of the Las Letras district to life. over 50 designers will descend on local shops, restaurants and landmarks to give them bold and colourful makeovers that often live well after the event comes to a close. Decoracion continues to solidify the neighbourhood's reputation as Madrid's new design district, and for budding urbanists provides a lesson as to how to rejuvenate an area by utilising local talent. With the recent announcement that Madrid will finally be getting its long-awaited public bike scheme, the city's premier documentary-focused cinema, the Cineteca, is playing host to the Bicycle Film Festival. The festival has been pedalling around cyclist-friendly cities worldwide, but will be stopping off in Madrid on the 28th and 29th of September. For Monocle in Madrid, I'm Liam Aldous.
So plenty to do if you're in Madrid this weekend, courtesy of Liam Aldous's recommendations there. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. We'll be back with a first here. The artist takes over the critic's seat here in Studio One. Brace yourselves.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
For Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Studio. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with me, Gillian Tobias and Emma Nelson. Now, regular listeners to the show may be familiar with some of the roster of critics and curators we invite into the studio to give us their take on the latest art exhibitions opening around the world. But today, we've decided to take a little bit of a different approach.
We're getting an artist's perspective on some current openings. I'm delighted to say our guide today is Julie Brooke. A new exhibition, Made Unmade, has just opened at London's Wapping Project. Welcome to the studio. Julie, thank you very much indeed for being our first artist come critic. Before we move on to the rest of your choices, which are sort of span the world, tell us a little bit about Made Unmade, which is just opened at the Wapping Project here in London.
It's about work that I've been making for the last 5-6 years in the deserts, in first of all Libya and then in northwest Namibia. And I'm essentially a sculptor and work in very remote landscapes, which I've been doing also in Scotland for many years. And as a way of trying to bring the work very closely to the audience, I've used film as my primary medium, which is unusual for what I do. Yes, very, very,
yeah,
very challenging. So it's a big film installation in that wonderful gallery in Wapping.
Well, can you just describe the Wapping Project space? Because it is quite unique in London to have the space. And I would think as an artist, and certainly for the work you do, it must be, you know, a joy to be able to exhibit there.
It's a sort of space that you walk into and you just go, yes, this is so fantastic. First of all, you come into the restaurant where there is still a lot of machinery from the old power station. But also it's been beautifully renovated in quite an industrial way, so it's very chic as well. And then you descend down into an enormous gallery, which is has a height of, you know, about 8 to 10 meters. So,
and it's very raw. It's not white walls, is it? It's almost like a brick boiler room.
It's exactly that. It was the boiler room, and so all the surface of the bricks is as it was when it was being used as a power station. And there's also another lovely room which I'm using called the coal store. I really like the names of these rooms. And the films are very sharply presented as screens, but it contrasts really beautifully with the brick and also actually this huge black void of the space above you in relation to the material.
Because your films are of the absolute expanse of the wilderness of the African desert, aren't they? What is it that draws you to such wild places?
I suppose I feel in my element being in very wild and unseen landscapes. And I first discovered that in Bodmin Moor in Cornwall, and then really explored that in Scotland, where there are many wild and solitary places. I think solitude does play a very big role in my desire to be in wild landscapes. And then I had the privilege to explore the desert in Libya, which is so incredibly beautiful, very, very stark. And that in turn led me to the Namibian desert, which is more of a semi-desert, not quite as stark as in Libya.
And I think it must be amazingly powerful to be able to create work and interact with these landscapes, not just be a passive admirer of these landscapes.
Well, I think in a way it's why I want to, why I'm sort of driven I by the interaction, and often it's very, very slight, but by even with quite a slight interaction, you can make such a different visual shift and physical shift in how you're looking at the landscape. And it's often very temporary as well. But it does exactly that. I think we often miss things in, as we walk through a landscape. And when you when you're looking to in some way make or express or respond to it, you see it in such a different way, and you're more alert to it. And by then making, you become even more alert to other possibilities. That's the nature of making, which any artist would speak about.
One of the artists you wanted to talk about was an exhibition by David Tremlett, a man, again, who takes his inspiration from travel. Tell us a bit more about his new exhibition, Artists' House Drawings, not about travel, but again, something you wanted to talk to us about.
Well, it's in the New Art Centre in Roche Court in Wiltshire, which is a space that's very interesting because they have an interior and exterior space to work with artists. And it sounds he has taken on the room with these drawings, but they drawing is something that really affects the space that you're seeing the drawing in. But he's taken it one step further, where his drawings are interacting with the actual architecture of the space. So it's not that far away from what I'm trying to do in the landscape, where you're shifting your orientation with the room. And they're very beautiful. They're quite geometric, they're very geometric and very minimal, using pigments and quite subdued colour. But they just ask you or invite you to relook at the room in a very different way and experience it sort of more pure three-dimensional terms, rather than just being in a room.
As an artist, when you travel the world for your work or pleasure, and you're looking at the cities and trying to work out what exhibitions to see, what's your checklist? We're viewers, we like to appreciate, wonderful, talented artists. But as an artist, what do you look for when you go and see an exhibition?
Well, of course, I have artists that I'm very drawn to because they might, in very different ways, be dealing with concerns that I'm very interested in. But equally, you can learn so much from any era of art, like it's just finishing now, but the Vermeer exhibition at the National Gallery. And it's such a privilege when an exhibition is pulled together of either, in Vermeer's case, there are so few paintings, when they're brought together, or of an exhibition where, like the James Turrell exhibition, where they're looking at a very new piece in the Guggenheim, but they're also looking at earlier work to allow someone to see the breadth of the work. And I think I'm very interested in seeing how work has evolved as well. So, for instance, often at the Tate exhibitions, they are inspirational in charting an exhibition from someone's very earlier work and how it's informing what they're doing now.
One exhibition that particularly draws attention to a period and a place which perhaps has not been discovered yet but is being discovered now is the Mexico exhibition at the Royal Academy here in London. That it focuses entirely on early 20th century revolutionary art, and it is an absolute revelation, isn't it?
It is. I think that era of working is incredibly powerful, very, very different again, more figurative, more narrative form, but actually was the very necessary form in which to express those that passion, that desire for change. And I think I think that other artists will be using a more formal abstraction of language that wouldn't have been suitable for that period when they were desiring that very, very passionate change.
And I suppose there it's that period. I think it was the art created after 1910, you know, when it was, you know, incredible violence and strife in Mexico. And it's always interesting to see that sort of social history, political history as seen through art. And it was a very productive period for Mexico, wasn't it?
Yes, incredible. And also them dealing with, you know, huge scale and a work being made outside, which is curiously not done nearly as much in the European world, that the power of the mural and the power of making work very, very accessible to everybody rather than it feeling a little bit more exclusive.
It is great, though, because it is an exhibition entirely of its time. I mean, the exhibits there, it's an awful lot of sombreros, but it's absolutely electrifyingly exciting to look at. You know exactly where you are and when you are.
Yes.
And there's a huge energy to the art in it.
Yes. I think that's something that I find, you know, you asked me what I look for, that passion, that energy, that sort of sense of drive and truth is something that's so important in the language of art. And when that, it can be through very quiet work as well, but it's actually the same level of energy. There it was necessary for it to be incredibly outward and exteriorized, whereas in some work it's more an interior language, but it's still got that same tension of passion.
Let's move on very briefly to an exhibition in Portugal, Paulo Rego, that you wanted to tell us about.
Yes. The Paulo Rego Museum in Cascais near Lisbon is a revelation in itself in terms of the building, and it is a continually moving series of exhibitions because it houses the biggest collection of her work. And she's currently got a new exhibition about the operas. And again, it's a very different sort of work that I immediately connect to. But I think she has got this power that you were talking about with the Mexican work, and of course uses a very strong figuration in which to express that and characters. But it's also very subversive, and it's it can look incredibly beautiful to the eye, and you get a little bit nearer and it's really sinister and very dark and dealing with extremely difficult issues as well in this figurative manner. So incredibly brave, courageous work. And that's something, again, I think courage is a very important part of making work and challenging oneself.
Julie Brooke, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Your latest exhibition, Made Unmade, has just opened at London's Wapping Project. That brings us to the end of the Saturday Review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilbao and researched by Henrietta Landells and Matt Alagaya. And our thanks too to our studio manager, Claire Urban.
We're handing back over to Georgina with the weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune into the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time with Tom Edwards and Marcus Hippie.
But you've been listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson, and Gillian DeBias. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.
Bye-bye.